All right, this topic, the secret code of creation, it's probably my personal favorite to talk about. This is just fun, and I hope you enjoy it. There was a movie a number of years ago called National Treasure, where Nicolas Cage discovered a secret code built on the back of this document, and that showed that there were some really intelligent people who had written that code in there. What if we found a code written into numbers? Numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4. What if we found a secret code built into them? What would that mean? It would mean the creator of numbers is intelligent. And indeed, there is such a code. There's a code of incredible beauty and infinite complexity built into numbers. And this code was only discovered in really the 1980s, not that long ago. And I want to share this with you this evening. And it's fascinating. And I think your minds will be blown. I've had a lot of people say, my mind was blown by that one. I'm like, me too. This is neat stuff. There's a little bit of preparatory work we have to do at first. It kind of reminds me of when I was young and my mother would prepare these wonderful meals. But sometimes she'd make something I didn't like broccoli. Ugh. And the rule was you had to eat everything on your plate before you were allowed to be excused. And so in rare moments of maturity, I would sometimes eat the broccoli first and get that out of the way so that I could then enjoy the rest of the meal. In that same spirit, we got a little broccoli to do first. But stay tuned because it's going to get really good really fast, okay? So here's the preparatory to work. We're going to talk about what are called sets. And in mathematics, a set is just a collection of elements, usually numbers, with a common defined property. And in that, it can be anything you want. You can define your own set. In most sets, some numbers are included and other numbers are excluded. So, for example, consider the set of even numbers, the set of even numbers. That will include those ones, and it will exclude all the other ones, right? And it's pretty easy to tell. You can just look at whether the number ends in 0, 2, 4, 6, or 8. You know it's even. It's evenly divisible by 2. We get that. Now, if I had a different set, different numbers will be included, and different numbers will be excluded. Consider the set of negative numbers. That's a different set, isn't it? And that includes these numbers, and it excludes all the other ones, doesn't it? Okay, so now those two sets are pretty easy. I can say the set of even numbers or the set of negative numbers, and you can tell just by looking at the number whether it belongs to the set or not. If in this case, if it's got a little minus sign in front of it, it belongs to the set. Okay, there are some sets that are a little more complicated. Their definition is such that you have to do a little bit of work to figure out whether the number belongs or not. And I'm going to tell you about one of these sets. It's called the Mandelbrot set. The Mandelbrot set. And it's defined according to this little formula that you see down there, which C is the number that you're testing to see whether or not it's a member of the Mandelbrot set. So if I'm checking to see if the number 3 is part of the Mandelbrot, then C equals 3. Z is another number. It's actually a sequence of numbers. That's what the little N means. So there's a first Z, Z1, Z2, Z3, Z4, and each one of them has a value. And the value of the next one is based on the previous one squared plus C. And I'll show you how this works because it sounds complicated, but it really isn't. It really isn't. The number C belongs to the Mandelbrot set if this other set of numbers, Z, stays small. Because when you generate the sequence of Z, it'll either stay small numbers like 2, 3, and, you know, negative 1 and so on. Or the sequence of Z will get really big. It'll be like 10, 100, a million, a billion, and so on. It'll get really big. If Z stays small, then C is part of the Mandelbrot set. If Z gets big, then C is not part of the Mandelbrot set. Let's do an example. I learned by example. Hopefully you do too. Is the number 1 part of the Mandelbrot set? So C equals 1. That's the number we're testing to see if it belongs or not. And so it'll be z squared plus 1, that's c, is the next value of z. The first value of z is always 0 by definition. And so that's the first. So the first thing that we try is 0. So zn will be 0. 0 squared, 0 times itself is 0, plus 1 is 1. There you go. So that's the next value of z. So we put that in. And since that's the next value of z, we put it back in the formula. It's the new value. So now we have 1 squared. 1 times 1 is 1 plus 1 is 2. That's the next value, z. There you go. Try it again. 2 squared is 4 plus 1 is 5. There you go. You put it back in. 5 squared, 25 plus 1 is 26. Put it back in. 26 squared plus 1. It's getting a big number, right? Now, we don't have to do any more to see what's happening. Is the sequence of Z staying small? No, it's getting big. So is the number 1 part of the Mandelbrot set? No, you got it. You got it. That's how it works. That's called a recursive algorithm. It's where you do something over and over again. But you don't have to do it more than a few times to see what's happening. You can see the pattern. The sequence of Z is getting big. Therefore, the number we were checking, the number 1, is not part of the Mandelbrot set. Let's try one more just so you can get the feel for it, because I know it's tedious. Is the number negative 1 part of the Mandelbrot set? So we'll check it. So this time, C equals negative 1. That's what we're testing. Z always starts as 0. So we have 0 squared, which is 0 minus 1, is? Negative 1. Okay, we put that back in. Negative 1 times squared, negative 1 times negative 1 is positive 1. Minus 1 is 0. Oh, put that back in. 0 squared minus what, negative 1. Oh, 0, negative 1, 0, negative 1, 0, negative 1. Is the sequence of Z staying small? Yes, it is. So is negative 1 part of the Mandelbrot set? Yes, you got it. Simple. Tedious, but simple. Right? It's not hard. You can now check any number to see whether or not it belongs to the Mandelbrot set. You know the rule. You just run it through that little formula. You put the number you're checking in for C, and you run it through that formula and see if Z gets big or stays small. If it stays small, it's part of the Mandelbrot set. Otherwise, it isn't. Here's one more complication, and then we'll get to the really cool stuff. Okay? The Mandelbrot set also includes what are called complex and imaginary numbers. And I hate the name imaginary because it makes it sound like we just made them up. They don't exist. They do exist. It's just a name. But an imaginary number is a number that when you multiply it by itself, you get a negative. And that's a little counterintuitive for us. How do you have a number that when you multiply it by itself, you get a negative? How do we comprehend that? But, you know, if it's just that it's kind of like when you're a little kid and you're first exposed to negative numbers. They're a little hard to comprehend at first because I can have 1 apple or 2 apples, but how do I have negative 3 apples? That doesn't make any sense, right? When you're a kid, negative numbers don't make sense. Then you get a little bit older, you get a bank account, suddenly negative numbers make a lot of sense, right? Yeah, yeah. Yes, I can have less than nothing. Yeah. Okay, it's the same way with imaginary numbers. Imaginary numbers do exist, it's just that most adults have never really played with them a lot. But there are numbers that when you square them are negative. Now, if you think about what that means, imaginary numbers cannot be a positive number because a positive number squared is a positive number, right? And imaginary numbers can't be negative because a negative number squared is a positive number. And imaginary numbers can't be zero because zero squared is zero. So how do we think of a number that's not positive, not negative, and not zero? Well, one way to picture it would be this. Consider a number line. And so you got, you know, negative 2 all the way out to negative infinity that way, all the way to 0, all the way out to positive infinity that way. Now, imaginary numbers are not positive. They're not to the right of 0. They're not negative. They're not to the left of 0. But they're also not 0. So where would you put an imaginary number? How about there? Ah, got to think outside the box a little bit, right? See, this number right here, it's not 0 because it's not down there. It's up there. It's not positive. It's not to the right of 0. It's not to the left of 0. That satisfies our conditions. So a neat way of thinking about the imaginary numbers is that they're on a different axis. They go this way. And the other numbers, the numbers that we're used to add insult to injury, the numbers we're used to are called real. Again, it's just a name. It's just a name. They both exist. They are equally true to the mind of God. Let's put it that way. But the real numbers are along this axis. The imaginary numbers are along that axis. And you can multiply. The lowercase letter I represents the number. It's kind of like the number 1, but in along the imaginary number line. It has a value of unity. It's just in the other direction. You can multiply that by any real number, like a half, and get another imaginary number, and so on. And negative I, and so on. So you have the imaginary axis. You can also have a number that's off axis, like that. And that would be called a complex number, because it has a real part and an imaginary part. The real part determines its x position, and the imaginary part determines its y position. So, okay? Now, the neat thing about complex numbers is you can plot any number you can plot any point on a plane using one number with its real part indicating the x position and its imaginary part indicating the y position. So that's one reason complex numbers are very useful, because they're two-dimensional. They exist in a plane. Now, what we want to do, because mathematicians were fascinated by the Mandelbrot set back in the 80s, because you can't tell just by looking at a number whether or not it belongs. We had to run it through that little formula, right? And it's not obvious, at least not to me, whether a number belongs. Like, does the number 1/2 belong to the Mandelbrot set? How about 1/4? You have to run it through that formula. And it's surprising that sometimes two numbers that are right next to each other, one of them belongs and the other one doesn't. And that was surprising to mathematicians. And they thought, what we'll do is we'll make a map of which numbers belong to the Mandelbrot set and see if there's a pattern. And in the 1980s, computers were finally fast enough to be able to solve that problem quickly because, you know, it took us a few minutes to work through to find out that the number 1 does not belong, but the number -1 does. We had to run it through that formula. Computers can do that fast, even faster today. And so what we'll do is we'll take the numbers that do belong and we'll color those black. We tested the number -1 and remember how it went 0, -1, 0, -1. So his D stayed small. So it is part of the Mandelbrot set. If we check 0, it also is part of the Mandelbrot set. And all the other points that do belong, we'll have the computer check them. And a shape starts to emerge. All these points do belong to the Mandelbrot set. The computer has checked them. It's run through that formula. Z stays small. And then for points that don't belong, we'll give them some other color, like red. Remember we checked the number 1 and found that it didn't belong. Z got really big. So we'll color it red. And as we check all the other points that don't belong, again, the computer is just checking these points, and it finds that these points do not belong to the Mandelbrot set. We see that there is a pattern. There is a pattern. What's it going to look like, though? It looks like it can't be like, you might think it would be a circle or something simple. There is a pattern, but it's not a simple pattern. As we plot more and more points, the pattern that you get is this. Isn't that remarkable and weird? And nobody was expecting that. You have this weird shape. And what I've done is I've color-coded it to where, remember, points that do belong are black. Points that don't belong, I give them a color like red. And if Z gets real big real fast, I make it a dark red. If Z gets big but kind of slow, I make it a brighter red. And if Z gets big but really slowly, but it still gets big, yellow. So yellow means you're close to the Mandelbrot set, but you're not on it. And that makes it easier to see the shape, basically. So this is a map of the Mandelbrot set. So now the computer's done all the work for us. It's gone through and checked each one of those points. And so now I can ask the question, does -1/2i belong to the Mandelbrot set? And you'd say, yes, because it's black. You can see that. Does the number 1.5 belong to the Mandelbrot set? Well, no, because it's way out here. It's very dark red. So there you go. Now I'm going to remove the coordinates now that you know what that represents, just so you can see the shape. And it was wild because nobody was expecting that shape. No one was expecting. This is just a map of which numbers belong to the Mandelbrot set. And the map is amazing and very sophisticated. It has a shape right here that's called a cardioid. And a cardioid is what happens when you take one circle and roll it around another, keeping your pencil attached to a certain point on the first circle. See? That's a cardioid. And that's exactly the shape that's produced. Why? I have no idea. I'm sure there's a reason for it. I just don't know what it is. That's wild. All the other shapes that we see, simple shapes, are circles. Circle, circle, circle. And they're perfect circles. And we got one of them back here that's right there. I mean, just amazing. That's the biggest one is right there. And then the one other shape that we see are these little tendrils that grow off, right? These little antennae that kind of spread off. And most of them are wiggly, but there's one that's perfectly straight, and it goes zip right out there. So it looks kind of like a bug or something. It's really weird. And we can zoom in on this because we can plot it at higher resolution and have the computer check points in between points and so on. And we find if we zoom in on this upper portion here, it has some really interesting properties. You'll notice that the largest circle on top here, it has a circle growing off of it, which has a circle growing off of it, and forms this antenna. And then it splits off into two others. So for a total of 1, 2, 3, right? Including the trunk and two branches, you get 3. Okay, that's interesting. Now, if you look at the next one down on the left, the next one branches off into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? The next one, I don't know if you can see that, but it branches off into 7. The next one, 9, 11, 13, 15, 17. Yeah. Somehow the Mandelbrot set knows how to count by odd numbers. All the odd numbers here, starting with 3, are represented on that side, and they go on forever. They get smaller and smaller, They never stop. And they get more and more of these tendrils. Each one has two more tendrils than the previous one. Wild. Why that happens, I have no idea. And neither did anyone else in the 80s. Now, whether mathematicians have figured that out by now, I don't know. But it's interesting. Now, on the right side, 1, 2, 3, 4, right? 5, 6, 7, 8. So the right side has the evens and odds. It's got all the numbers beginning with 3. And they go to infinity. They never stop. They just get smaller and smaller. You might think, well, how can you fit an infinite number in? It's a finite space. Because they get smaller faster than they reach that point. So it's interesting. They're infinite. And then what really I thought was just really blew my mind. If you look at the one in between the 5 and the 3, you can see it's got a lot of tendrils. Now, it turns out 5 plus 3 is 8. Lo and behold, that's exactly how many tendrils it has. And that's true for all of them. Every one of these, you pick the next biggest one, and like this is 3 and that's 4, this will have 7. You can take that one, and this one will have 3, and that will have 7, this will have 10. Somehow it adds the number of tendrils to the previous two. That is interesting. So this shape seems to really understand math well. It knows how to add, it knows how to count. Weird, despite the fact it's just a map of which numbers belong to the Mandelbrot set. Pretty wild. So that's true for all of them. Zoom back out. One of my favorite features of the Mandelbrot set, you might notice the spike here, and there's this little spot on the spike. And I wanted to see what that looked like, so let's zoom in on it. And it turns out it's another one. Oh, that's neat. Almost identical to the parent. It has the cardioid, and it's got the big circles, and it's got the little tendrils growing off of it. The only thing that's different is there's extra stuff growing off the exterior. There's extra spikes growing off of it. We zoomed in on a section of the spike, and the baby version has extra spikes. That's interesting. Now, I noticed, as I'm looking at this one, it's just like the parent. In fact, it's got a little... Oh, look at that. What could that be? And sure enough, it's another one. Wild. Almost identical to the parent, but it's got spikes growing off of spikes. And, of course, it's got one, too. Look at that. Now, you could do this forever. There's an infinite number of babies, as far as we know. Nobody's actually bothered to check, but they've gone in millions of times, and it doesn't stop. So this Mandelbrot set has an infinite number of baby versions built into itself on smaller and smaller scales. Anything like that has smaller versions of itself built in is called a fractal. So the Mandelbrot, or rather the map of the Mandelbrot set, is an example of a fractal. And you could do that for the rest of your life. You could zoom in on that. But look how small the grandbaby is compared to the parent. Look at that. Just amazing. Gives you a little window into the mind of God. I'm going to argue that God's mind is responsible for this shape because God's mind is responsible for all mathematical truths. Math is the way God thinks about numbers. And there's beauty in this and complexity in it. It's amazing. We'll find, too, that not only does the overall shape repeat, but if you zoom into any particular section of it, if you zoom into, you know, just pick a section and zoom in on it. And you might think, well, it'll stop at some point because, you know, eventually it'll smooth out. Man-made structures do. You zoom in far enough and then they're smooth, right? This is infinitely wiggly. It doesn't matter how much you zoom in. You could do that the rest of your life and it would continue forever. It's a complex pattern built into a complex pattern built into a complex pattern. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, it's fun to explore this shape, and that's what we're going to do now. It's just fun to see what God has built into this map of the Mandelbrot set. And we're going to zoom in on this valley here between the main cardioid and the main disc, this valley right here, which is called the Valley of the Seahorses. Mathematicians like to give fun names to these things because it looks like, on the right, it looks like upside-down seahorses. See that? There's a bunch of them there. Because we've zoomed in pretty deep, and so the number of tendrils, remember each one has two more than the previous one, and they start kind of wrapping around each other. It's amazing. Now the colors are arbitrary. By convention, points that do belong on the Mandelbrot set are always colored black. Points that are exterior, we can give them whatever color they want, so we'll change the colors every now and then just to keep things interesting. But I always assign a very bright color to a point that's very close to the Mandelbrot set, and then a darker color to points that are further away. In black, if you're exactly on the Mandelbrot set. So let's zoom in on one of these seahorses. So bright color means you're very close to the Mandelbrot set. And it might not seem that way at first, because you'd say, well, you know, these black points are the Mandelbrot set. This is not. This is far away.
this bright means it's very close to the Mandelbrot set, but doesn't look like it. It looks like it's way over here, whereas, let's try that again. It looks like it's way over here and the Mandelbrot set is there. What that means is there is a very thin black thread that is going out there and wiggling around and making that shape and splitting off into other threads and so on. So what this means is there is black here, it's just smaller than a pixel. Okay? So what you're seeing is a very complicated thread that has branched off of this circle. Well, that circle's branched off of it, and that circle's branched off of it, and it forms this complicated thread that weaves around and makes this amazingly complex and beautiful shape. No one was expecting that when you make a map of the Mandelbrot set, it's beautiful. It looks like a seahorse for some reason. Amazing. So let's zoom in on the center of that seahorse. I want to see what that spider web-like structure looks like, and that's what it looks like. I found from experience, if you zoom in on the center of that, you can do that forever. It doesn't really change very much. So let's go off to the side. I want to see what the spider web is made of. And so let's go off to the side here, and we'll find that the spider web is made of smaller spider webs. That's wild. Isn't that interesting? And there's sort of two, and they kind of collide in the middle, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, and then it'll go to 8, 16, 32. It's all the powers of 2. Pretty neat. And if you zoom in on that center one, well, how about that? Look at that. Isn't that neat? There's a baby built in there, too. And, of course, you'll notice it has a spike, and look at that. So it's just like the parent, but it's much, much smaller. And it's built into one of these spider web structures. And you'll notice it's identical to the parent, except the exterior. It's got extra stuff growing off the exterior. We zoomed into a spider web, and the exterior has all these spider web structures growing off of it. Really amazing. And look how much smaller it is compared to the original as we zoom back out. And each one of those has a baby Mandelbrot in it. So the Mandelbrot set not only has an infinite number of babies just here, everywhere on here has an infinite number of babies. It's an infinity of infinities. That'll keep you awake at night. Let's go back into the Valley of Seahorses. This time we'll go off to the left, which is called the Valley of the Double Spirals. So seahorses on the right. On the left, you have double spirals. I'll show you what I mean by that as we zoom in here. This is a double spiral. It's two spirals that wrap around each other. Because if you pick a strand, this strand right there, and follow it around, right there, there's a strand in between. See? This and this are the same. And this are the same. But this is not the same as that. It's two independent spirals that wrap around each other, like a spiral galaxy. Very beautiful, I think. And if we zoom in on that, I want to see what it's made of. Let's go off axis here a little bit. Amazing. So now you have these spider web type structures like we saw in the seahorses. You have more double spirals. So it's double spirals made of double spirals. And you have another structure here. I call them bow ties. Looks like a little bow tie, right? It's got two double spirals that intersect in the middle. I think they're beautiful, these little bow tie shapes. So let's zoom in on one of those. And again, you're just looking at a map of which points belong to that little formula, z squared plus c. These are the points that where z stays small, and it forms this complicated thread that is incredibly beautiful. So, and again, you go from 2, 1, 2 double spirals to 1, 2, 3, 4 to 8 to 16. And in the middle, you're not surprised this time, there's another baby version. Look at that. But you can see here the 8, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And this would be 16 here, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And then 32, 64, 128, and so on. Pretty amazing. So the Mandelbrot set knows how to multiply by powers of 2. You'll notice it's rotated around. Did you catch that? The valley's on this side, the cardioid's pointing the other way. That's because we zoomed in on a spiral. So it's been rotated around, you see. So again, the baby version's identical to the parent, except it's got extra double spirals growing off of it because we zoomed into a double spiral. So pretty amazing. And then the other place that's really interesting to explore, basically any valley is interesting and beautiful. So the one that, another big valley to explore is this one right here, sometimes called the Valley of the Elephants. We'll see why when we zoom in. You see how it looks like elephants? One marching after the other? Each one is growing on a circle. It kind of makes me a bit think of an elephant balancing on a circus ball, right? There's an elephant, one ball, one elephant, one ball, one elephant, one ball, and so on. And pretty amazing. This is the only symmetric valley. You get a mirror image of them up there. These elephants are hanging from the ceiling. So that's kind of neat. They get smaller as you go in, and their trunks get curlier as you go in. And there's an infinite number of elephants there. You could go left forever, and they don't run out. Their trunks get curlier, and they get smaller. So I thought I'd zoom in on one of these guys to see what they look like. So there's a couple of elephants. Each one elephant on one circle. Remember that, because we'll come back to that later. Each circle has a circle growing on top of it, circle growing on top of that, and they branch out and make an elephant. And then if you zoom in on the trunk that curls up makes this beautiful, interesting single spiral. It's just one spiral this time that wraps in on itself. So this thread and this thread are the same. And you can see that if you follow it around. They're the same thread. Now if you zoom in on that, what kind of shapes do you get? All kinds of shapes, including bow ties. But this time the bow ties are made of single spirals. So again, it kind of inherits the section of the parent it grows off of. It goes from 2 to 4 to 16 to 32 and so on as we zoom in on more on that. And it's stunningly beautiful. So there's the 4 and then the 8 and 16. And again, there's a little baby version in there that's been twisted around. So this was really surprising to mathematicians in the 1980s when they started plotting these things on IBM. Benoit Mandelbrot was the guy who worked at IBM. The set's named after him because he popularized it. He didn't discover it, but he popularized it. And he spent a lot of time plotting these shapes. And people weren't sure, is this real or is it something the computer made? Well, it's real. It's real. These are real shapes built into math. The computer just allows us to plot them. And you could spend the rest of your life studying this shape because it's infinite. You can zoom in forever. See, things in the physical world, you could zoom into the level of atoms and then that's kind of it, right? I mean, you have protons, neutrons, and then quarks, and we think quarks are elementary. But this, you could zoom in forever. It doesn't end. It's God zooming into the small forever. It's amazing. It's amazing. It gives you a little window into what it must be like to think like God, to have infinite amount of knowledge, infinite information in his mind. And of course, it's beautiful. And I can make sense of that as a Christian because I would expect math to be beautiful. Math is the way God thinks about numbers. Of course, it'll be beautiful. Everything God does is beautiful because that's his nature. And this is just a map of which numbers belong to that little formula. You could spend the rest of your life studying that shape and you wouldn't even scratch the surface because it's infinite. It's infinite. Keep in mind, even all those little baby Mandelbrots, they have a valley of seahorses too. You could zoom in on that and so on. But that's just one formula. It made me wonder what happens if you change the formula. So I thought, what happens if you do z cubed plus c? The answer is you get a different shape. Now I have another universe to explore. That's kind of neat. And so that's z cubed plus c. And if you look at look at the difference between the two, everything's gone up. Everything's increased. Like the Mandelbrot had, the main shape had one valley in it. This one has two. The Mandelbrot had circles growing off of them which have zero valleys. This one has shapes that have one valley. See how each of the valleys went up by one. And the other thing you can do too, the main shape here is called a nephroid, and that's what happens when you wrap a circle that's half the size of the original around it, keeping a pencil affixed to one point on the smaller circle. That's the exact shape you get, a nephroid. So everything went up by one. And the other thing I can do too is I can change the power gradually from 2 to 3. I was just curious to see what that would look. You can see how one shape morphs into the other. So there it goes. So I'm changing the power, 2.1, 2.3, 2.4, all the way up to 3, and then backwards. And so you can see how everything gets multiplied. And it's mainly on the left side that things get multiplied. On the right side, they stay similar. They still get changed. So it's interesting. The cardioid becomes a nephroid, and the circles become cardioids. Everything goes up by one. It's like getting upgraded to first class. You get moved up. So there you go. So isn't that neat? Some things get quadrupled, but most things get doubled. Now, let me back up and show you one more thing here. Come on. which aspect of it changes the least? I think it's right here. Would you agree with that? So it made me wonder,
if on this nephroid, do we have a valley of elephants? Because on the Mandelbrot, that was the valley of elephants, right? So do we have elephants? Let's zoom in and find out. We have elephants. Zoom in here a little bit more. Now keep in mind, on the Mandelbrot set,
you had one circle, one elephant. The circles have become cardioids, and now you have two elephants. The elephants have doubled, which is interesting because on the Mandelbrot set, we had an infinite number of elephants, and now we have twice that many. That's another thing that'll keep you up at night. Trust me. You can double infinity, apparently. That's cool. And so you have two. You have a bigger elephant in back, and then you have a smaller elephant in front with a curlier trunk. So again, I wanted to zoom in on this and see. Do you think we'll have bow ties again if we zoom in on the trunk? Let's try it. So instead of bow ties, they've gone from two to three. One, two, three. It looks like those fidget spinners that they have, right? So you see it gained a new, instead of having two, it's got three now. That's interesting. We went from the power two to three, and the bow ties went up to tri-ties. And if you zoom in on the middle of that, lo and behold, you've got the main shape, the baby version of the original. Fascinating. So this also has an infinite number of baby versions built into it, almost identical to the original shape. Amazing. So now I have another universe to explore. And again, you could spend the rest of your life studying that shape, and you never scratch the surface because it's infinite. So God is not just infinite, he's infinitely infinite. Something to think about. So what happens if you go z to the fourth? Well, you get that shape. Now I'm starting to see a pattern. Z cubed gives you kind of a twofold shape, 1, 2. Z to the fourth gives you a threefold shape. Apparently the shape is one less than the power. So z to the fifth will give you that. Z to the sixth will give you that. Z to the seventh gives you snowflakes. Sixfold symmetry. And if you zoom in on it, do you get snowflakes? Yes, you do. And they're beautiful. Then I tried negative powers. What do you get if you do a negative power? There's z to the negative 2. You get that. Now, this is interesting. A negative power is 1 over the positive power. It's the reciprocal, right? So z to the negative 2 is 1 divided by c squared. And what that does is it flips the shape inside out. Because, remember, black means it does belong. Colored means it doesn't. So this is all black now. All these points do belong to this form. Most of the universe belongs to this formula, except this little section in the middle. So you see it's taken the shape and flipped it inside out so that most of the universe belongs and a little portion of the inside doesn't. And if you zoom in on that, is it fractal? Well, the overall shape never repeats, but there are sections of it that have the same kind of characteristic. If I zoom in on this section here, to me it looks like overlapping pebbles, which I think is really beautiful. And if you zoom in on that, stunning. It does go on forever. You think it's going to stop. It doesn't. Well, it'll end in a... No, it keeps going on forever. So again, just a little window into the mind of God. So I hope that's something that is... I think that's amazing. So that's z to the negative 2. Z to the negative 3 gives you that one. And now I'm seeing a pattern as well. Apparently, the negative power... plus 1 is the number. It's negative 3 and you have 4. So negative 4 gives you 5. And z to the negative 5 is another way to make snowflakes. Inside out snowflakes. They're flipped around. It's just amazing that these shapes would be built into numbers by the creator of numbers. We don't think about God making numbers, but he is responsible for them. We think about God making mountains and people and animals and so on. But God is responsible for numbers. His mind is responsible for these shapes. And they're beautiful. And that makes sense from a Christian perspective, the shapes that you find built into numbers. Amazing. So what does all this mean? I mean, we've seen some pretty stuff here, but what does it mean? What causes the beauty in fractals? They are beautiful. Would you agree? They're beautiful. What causes the complexity in fractals? The fact that when you zoom in on them, they don't get simpler, they get more complex. And you find baby versions built into them. Well, first of all, what causes the beauty in fractals? Is it the man-made color scheme? I assigned the colors, right? I told you that black means it does belong, but then I can pick whatever color I like for points that don't belong, and I can shade it. And I think the colors I picked are pretty, but
You don't have to pick those colors. It's not the man-made color scheme that makes it pretty, because even if you do it in grayscale, it's still pretty. It's still beautiful. And I think the colors enhance it a little bit, perhaps the way salt brings out the flavor of a food, but it doesn't create the flavor. It just brings it out. It enhances it a little bit. So you can complain that I didn't pick colors you like, but the shape is beautiful. The shape is beautiful. So it's not the man-made color scheme that creates the beauty. It just perhaps enhances it a little bit. Did the computer create the beauty? Well, the computer didn't create the shape. It merely revealed it. Remember, the first two points we checked manually. The computer doesn't make it such that negative one belongs to the Mandelbrot set and one doesn't. That's just the nature of math. The computer simply reveals the shape quickly. Theoretically, you could plot this by hand. You could go through each one of those points and run it through that formula like we did with the first two. It would just take a long time. Computers do it fast. It didn't create the beauty. It revealed it. Did people make this? Well, we picked the formula. But what we saw just a little bit ago is it doesn't really matter too much what formula you pick. Now, not all formulas will reveal fractals, but a lot of them do. So it's not people were surprised by this beauty. It's not like somebody sat down and said, I'm going to draw a beautiful double spiral. Nobody did that. We were surprised when these shapes emerged when you run the computer and have it analyze this section for the Mandelbrot set. Apparently, the beauty is somehow built into math. It's built into math. Well, what causes the complexity in fractals? The fact that they're infinitely complex. You can zoom in on them forever, and they keep going and get more intricate as you zoom in. Did the computer make it? Well, again, the computer didn't create these shapes. These shapes have existed from eternity past. They're built into the mind of God. The computer didn't create them. The computer merely revealed them. In the same way that a microscope doesn't create bacteria, it just lets you see it. The computer lets us see these shapes. It plots them for us. But again, you could theoretically do it by hand. The computer didn't make it. Did human beings create it? Well, we certainly didn't. We were surprised when these shapes were revealed, and skeptical at first. Some people thought, well, this can't be real. But it is. Human beings didn't create this. We picked the formula, but once we picked the formula, the shape is determined by the laws of mathematics. It's not determined by us. Did the formula create it? Well, in a sense, I mean, we picked the formula, but what we found is if you change the formula, you still get this incredible complexity. The complexity is apparently built into math. Well, what is math exactly? I mean, we know it's that class in school that's kind of hard. But what is it? Well, math is defined, mathematics is the study of the relationship between numbers. And then, I'm going to ask, what are numbers? And he said, well, that's a stupid question. Have you ever thought about how to define numbers? It's interesting. The more basic something is to us, the harder it is to define. What are numbers? The best definition I could find in a dictionary are that numbers are a concept of quantity. I think that's a good definition. Now, a concept is something that exists in the mind. And numbers are a concept of quantity, of how much of something you have. Okay? But being a concept, they exist in the mind. You can't stub your toe on a number. They're conceptual. They exist in the mind. Numbers are concepts. They're abstract in nature, not physical. They're not made of atoms. You realize that? Numbers exist in a mind. Like that, you say, well, that's the number three. It exists right there. Is that really the number three? Because if it is, I just destroyed the number three. Children, sadly, will now have to count 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7. Because you told me that was three, and I got rid of it. That was a representation of three, wasn't it? That was a numeral. Written numerals are not numbers. They're representations of numbers. So we decided that when you draw this, that represents threeness. It represents three. And if you're Roman, you do it this way, right? And that represents... We decide what the numerals should look like. But we didn't create numbers. Numbers are concepts of quantity. Laws of mathematics are conceptual. Where do laws of math come from then? Did laws of... Let me take something like a biological structure. Because we've seen that there's complexity in math. Well, there's complexity in biology too, right? Animals are complex. And how did that complexity come about? Evolutionists have an answer for animals. They say that animals evolved. Animals are complex today, but they didn't start that way. Animals started very simple, and then over millions of years of mutations and natural selection, they evolved, right? Did laws of math evolve? That's a non-starter. Numbers don't evolve. It's not like 3, 7 used to be 3, but then it evolved. 2 + 2 used to equal 3, but now it equals 4, and it's and maybe in a million years it'll be 5. That doesn't make any sense.
Laws of math do not evolve. And so you cannot explain this complexity by evolution. You can't. I mean, you can't really do it for biology either.
But you certainly can't do it for math, because math doesn't evolve. It's unchanging. Were laws of math created by people? No, people were surprised by certain laws of math. We discover laws of math. Pythagoras didn't decide that triangles should add up that way. He discovered it, right? If he decided it to be that way, he could have made it simpler. He could say this, rather than squaring everything, let's just make the hypotenuse the sum of the other two sides. That's a lot easier. But that won't work. Don't hire an architect that believes that. Do they come from the universe? Laws of math go beyond the universe. The Mandelbrot set goes in infinitely. The universe, it doesn't go in infinitely because you get to atoms and then it breaks down and you get quarks and stuff, and that's it as far as we can tell. They don't come from the universe. Laws of math exist in the mind. And I would argue, well, they stem from the mind of God. The Christian worldview can make sense of this. Just like laws of logic, which we covered in the previous session, laws of mathematics. Mathematics really is a subset of logic. Math is the logic of numbers. If logic is the way God thinks about everything, math is the way God thinks about numbers. So it's a subset of logic. And as such, laws of mathematics are abstract and conceptual. They exist in the mind. They're universal. They apply everywhere. They're invariant. They don't change with time. And they're exceptionless. And if you paid attention last time, you know that makes sense because they stem from the mind of God. God's thoughts are conceptual because all thoughts are. God is omnipresent, so his thoughts apply everywhere. God does not change with time, therefore his thoughts don't. And God is sovereign, which means laws of math will be exceptionless. I can make sense of laws of math and the fact that they produce beauty and complexity when you examine certain sets in the complex plane. I can make sense of that as a Christian. But the naturalist has a problem. The naturalist believes that all that exists is matter and energy. You can't really have laws of mathematics in a naturalist universe. But here's the problem. Laws of mathematics are conceptual. They exist in a mind. And we know that it's not the human mind. Laws of mathematics existed before people. The way the planets orbit the sun, they obey mathematical laws. Kepler's laws, for example. The period squared is proportional to the distance cubed. That's a mathematical law. Now, the planets orbited perfectly well before people for 2 days. In the secular view, for billions of years before people, right? So the point is, math is not a product of human mind because math existed before people. Mathematical laws existed before people. Triangles added up the same way before Pythagoras discovered that. He wasn't the first, by the way. He just found a way to prove it. But in any case, you see the naturalist problem? They recognize that laws of math are conceptual. They exist in the mind. But they don't believe that there was intelligence before people, and yet they've got math before people. They've got a problem. They can't make sense of laws of math. I can, because I know there was a mind before people, and that mind is the mind of God. I can make sense of that. Okay, one more really interesting tacit here, and that is physical fractals. There are fractals, approximate fractals in nature. The kind of fractals we've been looking at exist only in the world of math. You can't stub your toe on the Mandelbrot set. It doesn't exist physically. It's a map of which points belong to the Mandelbrot set. It's abstract. It exists in the mind. And it's infinite. You can zoom in on it forever, and it repeats forever. You have babies of babies of babies to infinity. But there are things in the physical universe that you can touch, that you can stub your toe on, that have fractal-like qualities, that when you zoom in on them, you have smaller versions of them. Now, they don't go on forever because you get to the level of atoms, and atoms are not fractal. So the physical world contains many things which are approximate fractals, such as snowflakes. Snowflakes are fractal. Because when you zoom in on a snowflake, it looks like a smaller version of the overall shape. It has that six-fold symmetry. You can't tell how big this snowflake is just by looking at its shape. Because if you zoom in on it, it's got the same six-fold symmetry. So these little gems from heaven that the Lord sends us every year and scrape it off your car, that's annoying. They're actually beautiful. They're beautiful, and they're fractal in nature. The stuff that grows on your windows, have you seen that? It's fractal because it branches, and then it branches into branches, and the branches branch into branches, and so on. The branches look like the overall shape, roughly. It's not exact, but roughly. So I always thought that was fascinating, seeing that when I was a kid. I still think it's fascinating to look at that. It's beautiful. Ferns are fractal. Do you know that? They have a branch,
And then the branch branches into branches, and then the branches branch into smaller branches, which branch into smaller branches. That's a fern. I even found a type of fractal broccoli. So I guess broccoli is good. Broccoli is good for something after all. There you go. See how the overall shape is a cone, but it's made of smaller cones, which are made of smaller cones, which are made of smaller cones. How about that? It's called Romanesco broccoli. So I don't know if it tastes as bad as regular broccoli, but anyway, there it is. At least it looks cool. Coastlines are fractal. The way they branch and branch into branches and so on, they're fractal. The way mountains appear from above is fractal, because the way they branch and branch into smaller branches. Clouds are fractal. You zoom in on a small portion of a cloud, it kind of looks like the overall cloud. It doesn't repeat exactly, but it looks similar. Am I zoomed in on a very small section of a cloud, or is that the entire sky? It's hard to tell. That's called scale invariance. The small thing looks kind of like the big thing, fractal in nature. Lightning is fractal, because you have a branch, and then the branch branches into branches, which branch into branches. And each branch looks kind of like the overall lightning bolt. I could show you a spark, and if I didn't have context, you wouldn't know if it was a spark or a lightning bolt, because they look the same. And it's really cool if you watch it in slow motion. You can actually see how it branches, branching and branching and branching, until the leader connects, and then most of the current goes down the leader. So I think that's really neat. So here's my question then. Why do fractals occur both in math and the physical world? They occur in both, right? We've seen the mathematical fractals, like the Mandelbrot, that only exists, it's abstract. You can map it, but you can't touch it, because it doesn't exist in space. This shape, that's the version of the Mandelbrot that has the z to the seventh power. That doesn't exist physically. That's a map of which points belong to that formula. You can't touch it. It doesn't exist physically. This does. You can touch that every winter. This shape is part of the Mandelbrot set. It doesn't exist in the physical world. This does. Interesting. This shape is called a Barnsley fern. It's a mathematical graph. It may look like a plant, but it's a mathematical graph where each leaf is the entire shape. Let me show you. This is neat. The entire shape is the same as one leaf. Isn't that neat? You can do that again. You can do that forever. Barnsley fern, mathematical plot. But it resembles physical ferns that you can touch. This is a mathematical graph. That stuff grows on your windows. This is a mathematical shape that does not exist in the physical universe. This, unfortunately, does. That shape, part of the Mandelbrot set. You can't stub your toe on that or see it in a telescope, but that you can. Wow. Why do fractals occur both in the physical world and in math? Now, one answer to that is the physical universe obeys mathematical laws, which it does. E equals mc squared, right? The universe, the physical universe, obeys math. And so a secularist could say that's why it stands to reason, since you can find fractals in math and the universe obeys math, you'll find fractals in nature. That's a good answer as far as it goes. But now I'm going to ask, why does the physical universe obey math? Math exists. Math is something you do in the mind. The physical universe exists outside your mind. Why does it obey math? Well, from a Christian perspective, I can explain that. Math is a reflection of God's thoughts. And whose mind is it that's upholding the universe? God. So I can explain. The universe is upheld by the mind of God. The Bible tells us that Christ upholds all things by the word of his power. In him all things consist or hold together. And God thinks about things mathematically. So, of course, the physical universe will behave mathematically. It has to, because it's upheld by the mind of God. But the secular worldview cannot answer that. They can't. Because they can't account for the properties of laws of mathematics or why the physical universe is compelled to obey math, which is something you do in your mind. Why does the universe care about what happens in my mind? Well, it doesn't, but it cares about what happens in God's mind because God's controlling it. And by the way, if you think, I don't know, I think maybe some secularists could give an answer to that. They can't. There's a brilliant physicist named Eugene Wigner. He was apparently not a Christian, but he was brilliant. He was a Nobel Prize winner. Okay? Brilliant guy. And he wrote an article from his secular perspective called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. He's asking himself this question: why is it the physical universe obeys mathematical, conceptual laws?
He says it is difficult to avoid the impression that a miracle confronts us here, or the two miracles of the existence of laws of nature and the human mind's capacity to divine them.
Basically saying it's amazing enough that there are laws of nature, and it would be in a chance universe.
He says it's even more amazing we can discover them. Why do they happen to be congenial to our thinking? Why do they happen to be conveniently mathematical?
From his secular perspective, he's a brilliant guy. I'm not making fun of him. He's brilliant, smarter than I am. I'm not likely to win a Nobel Prize. He did.
Brilliant. But he couldn't answer that from a non-Christian perspective. That's my point. What's his conclusion? Here's his conclusion. The miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve.
Now, I know he's being a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I do have to point out that a gift implies a giver.
Yeah. He knows in his heart of hearts the biblical God. Everyone does. Romans 1 tells us that.
People suppress the truth and unrighteousness, but they do know God in their heart of hearts.
But he can't answer that question. He says, we just don't understand it. He said, we just hope it'll continue to work out for us. So we've seen that there's beauty of infinite complexity built into numbers, revealed when you run through that little formula and make a map of it. The map is amazing and totally unexpected. Numbers are abstract conceptions of quantity. They exist in the mind. Concepts always exist in the mind. That's what makes them concepts. Numbers are mental. Mathematics is mental. But it's not just human mental. When you're doing math, you're thinking God's thoughts after him. I wonder if little kids learned that and knew that, if they'd have a different attitude about math. You're learning to think like God thinks. That might change their perspective on it.
Numbers are a reflection of the way God thinks about quantities.
The secular worldview cannot account for the existence and properties of numbers or any mathematical truths. There are secular mathematicians. It's just, what do they think they're studying? I've often thought of that. Numbers existed before people, and yet they're concepts, meaning they exist in the mind. That means there's a mind before people. Now, I can make sense of that in the Christian worldview. Laws of math are universal, invariant, abstract entities. Makes sense because they reflect God's thinking. We've also seen that the physical world contains fractals, approximate fractals. The secular worldview cannot account for why the physical world obeys mathematical laws, but you as a Christian can, because the universe is controlled by the mind of God. Isn't that neat? I've never had any secularist be able to answer this. I've presented this to many people. I've never had a secularist be, no, I can explain why the universe obeys math. No, you can't. Not apart from Christianity. Well, we have this presentation on DVD, The Secret Code of Creation. And because it's so pretty, I made it on Blu-ray as well. So if you really want the colors to come out, DVDs are kind of dying, and Blu-rays probably are too. Streaming is the way of the future. But we still have these, and you can get those back there. I also have a book that goes along with this called Fractals, The Secret Code of Creation. It'll cover everything I covered today and some other equations, too, that we didn't have a chance to explore today. The neat thing about this book as well is it includes a CD with computer software, so you can explore these shapes yourself. And in fact, every image in the book is on the CD, and you can. The neat thing about the program I wrote, it contains both Mac and PC software. The program I wrote is PC, and you can take any of the shapes in the book, put them in that program, and continue to zoom in on them. It knows where they're at, and so it's kind of neat. And you can change the colors to whatever you like and kind of play with that. It's a lot of fun. So you can spend the rest of your life exploring any one of these shapes, and. If that isn't fun, I don't know what is. So,
Ultimate Proof of Creation, give you a bulletproof argument for the biblical worldview. That's probably my best book, I think.
I wish every student would get that before they go off to college, because it teaches you how to think properly. And we have that on DVD as well. Understanding Genesis, refuting the idea that, well, Genesis is myth or poetry or something like that. And we have that on DVD as well. Discerning Truth, if you want to dip your toe in the pool of logic, that's a good way to go. Lots of DVDs. Created Cosmos is the planetarium show I wrote for the Creation Museum. We have that on DVD. It's a lot of fun. Stargazer's Guide to the Night Sky, how to better enjoy the night sky from a Christian perspective. If you want to get a telescope, what kind you might want to get, how to use it, and so on. So that's a lot of fun. Even if you don't have a telescope, a lot of stuff you can see naked eye, or binoculars. You can see Jupiter's moons in binoculars. Saturn's rings, you can see Saturn's rings in binoculars. You just got to know which one's Saturn. That's where the book will help you. So there you go. Taking Back Astronomy refutes the billions of years, refutes the Big Bang, and so on. And we have a DVD that goes along with that called Astronomy Reveals Creation. Keeping Faith in an Age of Reason answers over 400 alleged Bible contradictions.
You got the physics of Einstein, if you've ever wondered about black holes and time travel and stuff like that. It's interesting. And it also covers the starlight issue of how God got the light from those galaxies to the Earth in the biblical time scale. Creation evangelism, how to use creation to better evangelize. Don't forget about our book packs, DVD packs, and our library pack, the best of everything. And please do sign up for our free monthly newsletter. There's no cost for that. It just kind of keeps you informed on what we're doing at the Biblical Science Institute. Check us out, biblicalscienceinstitute.com. We're in